So I called an audible. For the second time, I was supposed to be publishing my conversation with my friend Charla Bokikio about her daughter. And as I was preparing that episode and putting it together, I stopped myself and I thought, you know, I think this week I have to talk about what happened last Wednesday, January 6th, 2021. I just don't see how I can't. And so I first thought I was maybe going to do a mini-sode about it. And then I had this Zoom call scheduled with my friend Cooper to talk about a creative project that we're going to be doing together. And I texted him and I said, hey, do you want to maybe just, before we have our conversation about our project, do you want to maybe talk for a little bit about what happened last week? And we did, and I'm not really going to do much of an intro. You know what happened. You know what's going on. And here's our thoughts about it, okay? I would have done more of an intro, but I'm literally, this was a last second plan change. So this is it. From Blanket Fort Recording Studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer. And today I'm talking with my good friend Cooper Howell about the events of January 6th, 2021. I don't think that it's being handled with the appropriate gravity. And
I think the further away we get from it, like, I'm sure that day will have a name.
Yeah.
You know, all those events have a name. The Boston Tea Massacre. You know what I mean? There's always like a name to it. It's one of those events. Yeah, let's talk about it.
Okay. Yeah. So, well, I mean, anyone listening obviously is aware that radicalized Trump supporting right wing, and I don't even want to say far right. It's not even like this far right, like crazy fringe group. That's part of the downplaying. The idea that it's a fringe group, that it's mm-hmm. people on the outskirts. It's like I can't tell you how many people this week have tried to play it off. People that I've been talking with who are on the right have tried to play it off as a fringe group of a few radicals that we're all freaking out about, and then have also gone on to tell me all the reasons why it was like a justified siege. And I'm like, so wait, which is it though? Is it a few fringe people that you disagree with, or are you totally cool with what happened? Because you're saying both. And
yeah. I think what's so sad about this whole thing is that it, well, okay, let me start with the thing that makes me happy about it. Number one, as a Democrat, right, mm-hmm. watching what happened on the 6th was horrifying. And also at the same time, you watched the Republican Party basically split in half, right? Meaning that I assume for the next 12 years that Democrats will have the White House and the Senate and the House. You know what I'm saying? Because it was like it was a day in which the Republicans had to choose, are you a Trumpian or are you a conservative Republican? And they are not the same thing. Are you a Ted Cruz Republican or are you a Mitt Romney Republican? And it's not even in the same party anymore. They don't believe in the same things.
Right.
You know,
right.
And watching this like Republican civil war that's going to happen basically is, it doesn't make me happy. I shouldn't say it makes me happy, but like it's something that needed to happen. There are some great things about the Conservative Party and they really needed to get their morality in check after Trump. And this is the thing that's going to do it.
Well,
you know?
The insurgency was there to cannibalize their own. Like they were there with Republican names on their hit list. Like they were there, they were coming for Mike Pence and they were coming for like anyone who wasn't going to object to the certification of the election. Like they were coming for mm-hmm. all these rhinos, all these, you know, Republicans in name only. Like they were there coming for their own. They were chanting, hang Mike Pence.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really scary. It's really scary. It literally felt like September 11th that day. Like watching the news in real time, watching it happen was you were clearly watching a turning point in American history, and it'll be so interesting and scary to see what sort of the fallout is of this and where it will lead our country.
So that's what I want to talk about, though, too, a little bit is because I agree with you. And I was saying to a lot of friends on the 6th, I was talking to Carlton Bluford and I talked on the phone for like an hour.
Yeah.
He texted me.
Love
and was just kind of like, I just need to talk to someone because I'm kind of freaking out. I was freaking out. I was having a lot of like anxious energy. I talked to Will Richardson on the phone for a while. Like I talked to several of my friends on the phone and we just sort of like vented to each other. I talked to my brother. But one of the things that I was saying to people is exactly what you just said, where I was like, here's the upshot. It looks like the Democrats should be able to have legislative power for at least the next 12 years, which means we'll have an opportunity to kind of show them that like it's okay for people to have healthcare and that people that the ultra wealthy can afford higher taxes and like okay, we're not going to crumble and burn, like we're you know, cuz they really believe with all their might that in 8 years or less they will all be in detention camps, that AOC is coming to round them all up and put them in re-education camps, and that we are going to devolve into some kind of like hellish nightmare scape. And I've been saying to people all week long that are on this side, I've been going, when that doesn't happen in 8, 10, 12, 15 years, will you stop? Will you say you were wrong? Or
no, that's the thing. Like Joe Biden could literally go on national television and crucify himself onto the Abraham Lincoln statue and die for all of the Republican sins, and they still would hate him. There is absolutely nothing he could do to make them believe that he isn't evil. That's the thing. Like I'm sure you and everyone who's listening has had a full week of trying to talk to family members, friends, acquaintances on all forms of social media and be like, there is absolutely no evidence that Joe Biden stole the election. There is absolutely no, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, okay, if he won the presidency, why didn't they steal the Senate and the House? And there's no convincing them.
Why did the exact same piece of paper that elected several Republican congressmen and women and Republican senators, why did that exact same piece of paper contain fraudulent material for the president, but not for the rest of the, like how does this work? What we're really seeing when it comes to stuff like that is we are seeing, and this is why people keep calling it a cult, because this is what cults do. It's the breakdown in the ability to think critically. Like, it's really not difficult to suss this out and go, okay, let's go with the idea that it was a giant inside job, it was rigged, it was stolen. How does this all work? Let's parse this out and think critically about it and try to figure out why certain aspects of the election weren't stolen, but this one was, and why that would be the plan and how that plan was executed. And Donald Trump calls Georgia and says, you need to find me 12,000 votes, and the Republican people, the Republicans on the phone in Georgia that he's talking to are saying, sir, they just don't exist. That's just not real.
Those aren't facts.
That's just not real. And he's just telling them.
And then they can publish that entire phone call and Republicans can listen to it and be like, oh, that was a doctored phone call. That wasn't real. You know, like it really is a cult. And what I've been thinking is, what are the breakdowns? What happened in history that allowed all of these people in America to get to this place? You know what I'm saying? What were the moments? Like, we all know what they have to say, and we all know all the truths that they are unwilling to see. But why did this happen? What events happened that Donald Trump capitalized on so hard to make them get to a place where they could defend basically the terrorist attack of their own party on January 6th.
I talked to my brother about this before it all happened. We had an episode where we recapped 2020, and one of the things we talked about was the election and was, you know, the fraudulent conspiracy theory and everything like that. And my brother at the time of recording the episode kind of contended with me that he felt like the majority of people who voted for Donald Trump were probably reasonable people who just liked his policies, and it was probably a minority of Trump voters who were actually radicalized and believed every word the guy said. And I said, okay, but if that's true, I haven't seen these people. I don't know a single person that voted for him that agrees with the outcome of the election. Not one. I don't know a single one. So I was like, so I don't know where these people are. And my brother has since actually walked that back. Like when, and I'm not saying this to throw my brother under the bus. He's a very smart person.
Yeah.
And, but he, after the 6th happened, he messaged me that day and he was like, I kind of regret saying what I said on your podcast. He's like, I think I missed how radicalized these people have become. And he sort of walked that back. But what I want to say is, where I think he might be right is when talking about what are the events, what are the things that happen? Obviously, when we talk about white supremacy and white nationalists, like that has always existed in America. There have always been factions of white supremacists and white nationalists. And that is definitely one of the accelerants in this fire that is like, that is giving fuel to it.
Yeah.
But where I think my brother might have a point is, I don't necessarily think that it's all of the Trump supporters who are avowed white supremacists and white nationalists. That might be like just a few million, an alarming amount.
Mm-hmm.
But like, so the question is, what happened to make otherwise reasonable people who aren't really in their day-to-day lives out and out racists or nationalists or insane people who are capable of compassion and empathy and kindness, what made otherwise rational, reasonable people support this kind of insanity?
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I am trying to explore a lot in my art, and I'm so glad we're having this conversation, is, and the thing that the last 5 years has really, really taught me is that we don't talk about how much people hate to work on themselves. People hate to do hard things. Like, human beings have this crippling addiction to comfort, a crippling addiction to comfort. We do not like to be told things that we need to work on because we do not like to work on things.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm looking at people, I've been thinking a lot about the theory of tribalism, which is whether or not you actually agree with something, an opinion, because you feel everyone else around you believes it, you have to believe it too. And me and you were raised in Utah, right? Where, I don't know about you, but my entire life it was like, Hillary Clinton is evil, abortion is murder, the Church of Jesus Christ is the only true church on the earth. And if you're not a member of it, you can't be happy. And, you know, there's just like some ideas that we were raised with. And when we were countered with anything on the contrary, we had all of these different like opinions and viewpoints from everyone around us to kind of be like, no, I don't need to critically think about that because everyone around me thinks like that. And I'm thinking about, okay, so say I lived in like Rexburg, Idaho, right? And I like critically thought about the election. I critically thought about like democratic issues. It would be terrifying to come out to all of your friends and neighbors and be like, hey, I feel this way, and have everyone around you like be different. You know what I'm saying? So it just sort of like, I feel like people don't want to think critically, and if they have to think critically, they won't change their opinion because they're just afraid that they'll sort of be exiled from their communities. So that's why like every one of those red states stays red. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's why when you show them facts and figures, like, did you know that 200 Republican judges appointed by Trump shot down different legislations about stealing the elections because there were no evidence. And they'll like make up some conspiracy or something that they heard from their friends and neighbors to explain it away instead of actually like taking in that information and like doing the hard work that it takes to actually think differently.
Well, that's what's crazy, you know? is the amount of people that I've talked to this week who just about this event, just about the 6th, where they're coming back to me with what, with literally like what, and they'll say, well, what I've heard is that it was only 82 people and that no one actually died except for that one woman who was shot by the cops. And that's what I heard. And I'm like, hey, listen, you don't need to go off of what you heard. You really don't. Like, there's video and photo evidence and hundreds of eyewitness testimonies. Like, you don't need to go off of what you heard, what someone said to you. This is, again, we're seeing the breakdown in the ability to think critically, because it's like I just had a conversation yesterday with a person who was just contending and was absolutely certain that because there have only been 82 arrests made, there were only 82 people involved in the siege. And I was like, this isn't a thing that you need to like you can, it is so easy to access the videos and the photos. You are being so willfully ignorant of the facts here.
Yeah. One of my favorite, I guess I shouldn't say favorite, but yesterday, this woman that was a member of my congregation, my Mormon congregation growing up, she, had this long monologue on Facebook about the First Amendment rights, like freedom of speech, and how Trump being banned from Twitter is like a freedom of speech issue. And I was telling her that it actually isn't, and you know, she was going on about how it is, and I video recorded on my phone. I like opened the Safari app and then I typed in her question, and I went through 20 articles on Google of different sites, of different like Fox News, like BBC, like all sorts of different articles where it's like, if you did like a, just a general Google search, you could debunk this fact. And I send it to her, and this person who I knew my whole life, she blocked me. And it was like, so instead of actually like thinking about that, okay, maybe I don't have all the information, that the way I'm thinking isn't wrong, it's so much easier to just cut me out of her life completely.
Yeah, it feels like they're immune to new information. Like it repels off of their brains. Like
which is why Joe Biden can do nothing and they will still believe the things that they believe in, which is scary because a lot of his policies are going to directly help them, you know?
Yeah. So that's what I was going to say though at the beginning when we were talking about how like the upshot is we've got maybe bare minimum 12 years of control, which we can get a lot done in those 12 years. Maybe we've got 16 years, but like that's the upshot. Yeah. The scary thing about this is since there's no chance of changing minds here, and we're just seeing that like evidence does nothing to change minds, maybe over time we can sway some, which is why I think we need to keep having conversations and need to keep pushing back on misinformation when we see it and need to keep calling lies lies. But since this indoctrination is so deep and these people are so adverse to any kind of new information coming in, I also look at the 6th as we may no longer be able to have peaceful transfers of power moving forward in this country.
Yeah.
So we may no longer ever be able to have a simple, reasonable election that everyone can just agree on, that there's winners and losers. And like this may set a precedent for now these people are going to push violently back until there is a breaking point of civil war. Like this feels like the kind of thing that topples great nations. It feels like
it is the
first big crack in a dam that has been holding back this wall of like radical rhetoric. And that's what's scary is, we might have control, but also like, what if we're just in a chaotic world for the next 12 years where anytime we pass any legislation, it's met with this kind of opposition, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge history nerd, and the thing that always strikes me about history, especially the history of empires and history of great nations, is that they're almost always toppled from inside.
Mm-hmm.
It's always an inside job. It's never an outside job. And it does, it, You know, I don't know. I feel like the pendulum always swings, you know, and so it could happen. It could be a number of things. Again, I do think that a lot of the policies that this new administration wants to bring forward are things that will help America, like, actually become great again. You know, if we can become a nation that is that does have universal health care, like true universal health care, like that they have in the UK, like they have in Canada, that will greatly benefit, especially the majority of those Trump voters.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And they will never give Biden or Democrats the credit for it. I'm sure there will be a bunch of conspiracies and a bunch of really hard conversations that will have to be had to convince them that it is a good thing. But I don't know. I still have hope. I still have hope. And I also just believe in democracy. So I don't know, but it'll be really interesting to sort of sit from our vantage point and watch what happens to the Conservative Party. It'll be really, really interesting.
It's so tough because they're always moving the goalposts and they're always changing the topic when they get disproven. So it's just like that thing of saying, like, okay, in 10 years when that doesn't happen, will you say, oh, looks like I was wrong? And it's like, no, you'll have a new thing. You'll have a new thing that's evidence for why you were right all along. And this has been happening. A friend of mine listed all the ways in which the Democrats have been that prove that the Democrats have been trying to erode God from America for the last 100 years, starting with separation of church and state, and then going through to, like, you know, taking prayer out of schools and all, and going through to gay marriage, of course, being legalized and all this stuff. And I was like, nowhere in this list, first of all, from the get-go, when separation of church and state was happening, there were people saying what you're saying right now, that this means within a matter of years, we're going to be living in a godless, lawless, crazy, chaotic hellscape. It never happened. It never came to pass. It still has not happened. There is not a single elected official in America that does not believe in God. There are no atheist politicians. None. There is zero representation for atheists in American governance.
Yeah.
Still, in the year 2021, I think there should be. I think
that's interesting.
There should be atheist politicians.
There will be. Yeah, I'm sure there will. Yeah.
But, like, there's none. And so this whole idea that, like, it's a slippery slope, eventually there's going to be no God. And not realizing that if you just, again, think critically and recontextualize that narrative to, oh, some legislators realized, you know what, we're not simply a Christian nation, we're a pluralistic nation and a pluralistic society of many religions, so it doesn't make sense for us to pray to Christian God in public schools. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
We're not doing a good job of representing our populace when we operate under Christian values, because we're a pluralistic society. So it's more about being a more inclusive society and a more equally represented society than it is about a war on Christianity. But they can't take it that extra next step and think critically about it and recontextualize the narrative.
And when did the Christian God become the God of chaos? You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, Jesus has now become like what, like Mars was to the Roman Empire. He's like the God of war. And all of the evils, there are so many evils that are being done in his name, which is, like, literally a prophecy in the Bible, which I think is hypocritical and hilarious. But it doesn't really make sense. And that's a really good point. I hadn't really even thought about that before, you know? I just don't understand how we can live in a nation where there is a giant group of people who not only cannot critically think about actual issues that affect them, but are completely judgmental towards people who think differently than they are. And that's literally why our nation was born. But I've got to also, like, I got to give them, I don't have to give them credit, but, you know, I think everything that we've said today is something that they can literally turn exactly around and be like, we don't understand how you guys can think this and this and this and this and this. And that's why this is so tricky, right? How do you, it's not just a matter of convincing them that they're wrong. It's a matter of convincing them to think critically, like you said, you know, and telling them that they are wrong is only going to make them believe in the thing that they believe in more, right?
Right.
Like, Facebook is a war right now. It's a war zone. And after the 6th, I was just so mad. And I was mostly mad because of, like, you know, the hypocrisy of if all those supporters were black, they'd all be dead. And that's, like, a whole other conversation. But, you know, I went on Facebook and I went on a tirade and I just, like, scrolled through my friend's posts and looked for trolls and just, like, blasted them because I was so angry. And I think I did a lot of damage to people. I put people's ability to actually think critically about issues. I pushed it back for years because I was so angry. And it's hard. It's hard to do.
I think I've done that too. And you know, part of me is kind of like I got on this whole trip about just like, I'm not going to be able to convince these people anyway. They are so incapable of seeing that the sky is blue when you know, they're so incapable of seeing their hand in front of their face that I'm not even trying to convince them anymore. I'm just trying to like out them. Like I'm going to keep asking questions until they reveal who they are. And like, I'm just going to keep like pushing until it's like, and there it is. And there it is. Where it's like, you know, you start the conversation by saying, you don't know anything about me. I don't even like Donald Trump. I don't even like the guy. I just like his policies. You think you know me, dumb libtard? I don't even like that. I shouldn't have said that word. I don't like that word. But they're like, you think you know me?
Yeah.
You don't know me. I don't even like Donald Trump. And then I push and push and push. And then I get to what they actually believe. And they reveal to me, well, that's because you don't believe in the deep state. I believe that there's a deep state of pedophiles that have been world leaders going back 30 years. And Donald Trump is dismantling this group of pedophiles. And that's why they hate Donald Trump and why they smear his name in the media. And I'm like, okay, so let's stop. We started this conversation with you saying that you don't really like Donald Trump. And we have arrived at a place where you told me that you think that there is a worldwide conspiratorial web of powerful pedophiles and that Donald Trump is the superhero who is dismantling that web. And that's why people hate him. Like we actually got to it.
Yeah. But I think even further, were you to ask more questions, That's not really them revealing who they are. Like them believing in QAnon isn't who they actually are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing that I have noticed, the pattern that I've noticed in most of the Trump supporter friends that I know, is that they have a deep, almost pathological need to feel seen.
Mm-hmm.
There is something in their lives that either happened, a trauma or just it's not just tribalism. It's like a feeling of not being recognized.
Mm-hmm.
A feeling that Donald Trump, him like saying the things he is and being so brash, makes them feel seen. And so arguing against them, it almost feels like you're taking away their basic human right to feel important. That they exist, that they matter. It's a lot of people who are really upset about the normality of their life, you know?
Yeah.
From a lot of places in America where they feel like where they live is a place that doesn't matter, like bumfuck nowhere, Nebraska, or like middle of nowhere, Tennessee.
Yeah.
Like I'm a person that like I can live and die and no one will remember me. But Donald Trump makes me feel like I actually matter. And I guess I didn't realize that there are so many people in this country that felt like they didn't matter. And I think that's just politics's fault in the politics's. I love this word I just made up, but it's political. It's the American political system's fault in the first place, where it's been very corrupt for a very long time. And most of our presidents have been from like a very elite group of like white people and they all like change hands. They all went to like Yale and Harvard. They were all like somebodies, you know what I mean? And I just feel like they have never had a leader or a president that spoke to them and actually made them feel like they were important. So how do we make people with a cult-like mindset towards Trump feel important while still inviting them to think critically?
Yeah, you know? I think the great thing about all these cult documentaries that have been coming out, Nexium, and what was the one you told me to watch? Hell.
It's called Holy Hell.
Holy Hell.
Oh God, it's so good.
I need to watch it. But what we see with the process of like reclaiming some of these people, like that story of that mother who got her daughter back from Nexium, and the way that she just keeps coming back to her daughter with firmness about the fact that, like, sweetie, you've been deceived and like you're like you're not part of a good thing, but also like love and still coming back with this spirit of love. I think you're actually right. I don't think that what I'm doing is helping. I think it's born out of just fear and
rage
and the feeling of like we're in an intellectual war on an intellectual battlefield right now, and I cannot
with an enemy that won't actually be intellectual. That's what's hard. Yeah,
with an enemy that will not engage with me in a fair, good faith debate. That won't concede points when they are clearly beaten. That won't concede ground when they are clearly beaten. When it's just like you are so clearly beaten on this point, and all they can do is switch topics and switch gears and go, what about? And usually they'll switch gears to something else that's also just equally insane. They'll be like, well, what about?
Or I'm sure you've also noticed too, like arguing with people and they'll be like, it doesn't matter. We're just going to agree to disagree. And then you like ask your question again and they're like, well, you're just like, you're just liberal and there's nothing, like they don't actually answer the question.
Yeah. I had a similar experience to what you had with that friend where you were like, and then I showed me Googling the thing. Because I've also gotten sick of people saying, prove it to me or like, show me evidence. And I'm like, it'll be the first thing that it'll be the first 10 things if you Google it. I promise.
Yeah.
I promise, go do it yourself. I really don't want to right now, but like, that doesn't mean that you're right.
Yeah.
I promise it'll be the first, but like someone, I said something about, I was arguing with a group of Trump supporters about whether or not what happened on the 6th was intended to be violent, because they were using they were just going, oh, what, you think a bunch of idiots taking selfies in the Senate room is violence? And I'm like, listen.
Or like the noose that they hung outside of the...
They failed their mission. They were there to do violence. They failed. The senators and legislators were able to be evacuated off the floor before they got in, and so no one was able to be taken hostage. But they came in with tactical gear and zip ties. Multiple Capitol Hill police officers have given testimony that who they were up against was a trained militia in tactical gear. So I say that in this comment section, and this guy goes, again, I haven't heard of anyone using zip ties or tactical gear. Again, this phrasing, I haven't heard of. So he's utilizing his community, and his community is saying, liberals are lying about people using tactical gear and zip ties. So I go, okay, I go in, Google, man in tactical gear with zip ties at the Capitol siege. It's the first 100 photos in a Google image search. So I say that to him. I'm like, this is the first 100 photos in the Google image search. You really should be able to go and just look for yourself. The other thing that I've heard that I think is so fun is, so they first of all say that it was only 82 people that got into the Capitol. You can just watch.
I haven't heard that.
Can just watch any video. But then they also say that it was 82 people out of a total 8 million who were there for the protest. And I'm like, do you guys know how many people 8 million is? Do you understand how much, like, I went to the Women's March
in the population of New York City.
Like, I went to the Women's March in New York City. It was the most people I've ever seen in one place ever in my life. It was 20 full square blocks of New York City, wall to wall with people. It was insane. Uh-huh. And it was like 250,000 people. Do you know how many people 8 million people is? Like, there were not 8 million people there. There were probably 8,000.
And that's still a lot of people too. That's a lot of people. So what's the solution then? How do you you, because something that you said concerned me, not the fact that you said it, but that I think it could be true, that while it is my personal opinion, and maybe I'm just like too much of an optimist, I do think that, you know, I do think we will have the White House for the next 12 to 16 years. But I also do believe that the Biden administration will do some really wonderful things. And I think that this, a lot of this unrest will, I don't know if it will go away, but I don't know if it will like crescendo into something. But there is this other very realistic part that it could turn. It already is an intellectual civil war. And if it turned into an actual civil war, it's different because it's like, it's not like 1861 where there's like an actual geographical line that separates the Union and the Confederacy. You know, it's like our friends and neighbors. So how do you fight a civil war within your community when it is everywhere? Is it, you know what I mean? Like how do they become their own nation, their own entity when it's like literally next door?
Well, this is why I think that it's of the utmost importance, and we're probably going to fail to do this, but it was so important that we would be able to remove Donald Trump from office and then bring charges against him and hold him accountable for his crimes. Because I think nothing brings down a dangerous cult and ideology quicker than seeing their hero leader brought down to size. Like, seeing Keith Raniere humiliated.
But would that make him a martyr?
Well, no? But sometimes it does. But like, I would argue that like the FLDS Church, for example, has been severely weakened by the imprisonment of Warren Phelps, and that like having him put in prison and being shown to the world as a pedophile and a child marrier and a child rapist and put in prison for that, and having the whole world see that and having them on display, pushes them kind of like in deeper into the shadows and deeper into the fringes of society, and makes them more reasonable people. Like, I can't be aligned with something that is that the whole world agrees is evil. And
that's a very, very good point, Austin. Like, that's very good. Like, if you cripple the leader, it gives it like takes away the power that they feel that they have. That is a very good point.
Where if you just go, because if you just show like, look, he's just a man, and he's a confused, bad, scared, like liar man. He's a con man.
Yeah.
And you strip away the facade and you show him in an orange jumpsuit with his hair all disheveled and like maybe like a 5 o'clock shadow, hasn't been able to shave for a few days, and he comes out just looking pathetic and scared and sad, and you take away his $50,000 a year hairstylist and his terrible long red tie, and you take away all the
and his skin actually turns white again.
Yes, exactly. And you see him for what he is. You take off his fake tan and you show him in front of the world for what he is, that he is a con man, that he is a liar. And I think that, okay, you're not going to get everyone, but like,
no,
but like NXIVM is officially done because Keith Raniere's serving 20 consecutive life sentences. And like anyone who bought into that ideology is probably right now, I bet the majority of people who were dyed in the wool members when this all went down are like running for the hills, and they're effectively over. Now, this is a much bigger scale thing, but I think one of our best shots at delivering a really serious blow was to have decisive action taken on Donald Trump, and it looks like we're not going to be able to get that chance, which is scary.
Yeah. But didn't DC just barely, I read something that the District of Columbia is pressed charges against Donald Trump individually for inciting a riot. Yeah. So I feel like there are many, many chances. And, you know, he still has that huge court case in New York about tax fraud that's still underway. There's many, many chances for that to happen. And it will also be interesting to see what happens to the Trump franchise. All those hotels, all those resorts, like, what's going to happen there? You know, the name Trump will go down for the rest of time as having sort of this insane stamp of history on it. you know?
Yeah, because I think that up to a certain point, you can have a persecution complex that like bolsters the movement where like, and you saw this with Nexium too, where like for a while, Keith Raniere was involved in lawsuits with former ex-members and he like was sort of settling in those lawsuits with people. And that was proof to the membership that he was beset by enemies, but he was coming out victorious. I think that the best hope for Trumpians to recover from their delusional state is to like shatter the Trump image, to like to cripple the Trump industry, to because initially there will be people having a persecution complex, just like they are with him being banned off Twitter, that like, oh, this is you're taking away our free speech, you're coming for our free speech. There will be this victim and persecution complex that will follow. But if you just, I don't think we can let up. I think we need to continue the blows, because what's happening right now that's really positive is the entire world agrees that Donald Trump incited what happened on the 6th, that it was a attempted self-coup. There is a thing called a self-coup that many authoritarian regimes throughout history have tried, that it was an attempted and failed self-coup. The entire world agrees with this. The only people in the world who don't agree with it are right-wing Trumpian Americans. That's it.
So you
just make it more and more clear that the entire species is on board with the fact that this guy is going to go down in history as the worst president in the history of America. And
for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. I guess we just have to do the work, all of us as individuals, to reach out to the people that we know that we do believe we can have a conversation with, and just invite them to think critically without telling them that they're wrong. And that's the hardest thing in the world to do. But if we like unite as a people and just are like, well, they're wrong, fuck them, let's just do our own thing. You know, we need each other for America to actually be great, you know? And yelling at people on social media is just not the way. It's just not the way to do it, you know?
Yeah, I know.
It's not.
I'll stop, I promise.
I need to as well. And what I also realized too is that on social media, most of these people wouldn't be able to have the arguments that they're having in person. You know, they're hiding behind a screen, and that feels like it enables them to be really radical and whatever. But face-to-face conversations about this are much, much different. You know, tone has a lot to do with it. You know, so I don't know. People don't actually vote based on intelligence. They vote based off emotion, you know? And if you are giving them the emotion that they, you know, aren't important, that they are stupid people, they will just continue to intellectually believe what they believe, no matter how good your intellectual argument actually is, you know?
Yeah, I said to a friend today, because he sent me,
I don't know.
A friend sent me this big long thing in a private message where he was like talking about Jacob Rothschild, who's like one of the internet's favorite boogeymen, you know, like the Rothschild family that owns everything and that operates
the Illuminati.
Everything. Yeah. And so he was telling me about that. And I was like, cool. So like, we've had several conversations about how you consider yourself a very skeptical person who questions narratives and who never takes anything that like a rich, powerful person says as like the truth. Like, you always question people and you want to like find your own answers. And I said, and I actually really admire that about you. And I think that like you really do show a lot of like healthy attributes that a good critical thinker needs to have. But I challenged him and I said, I wonder why it is that you don't apply this same standard of strict skepticism and questioning to Donald Trump. You accept anything he says as ironclad proof that, I mean, like, there are 5 years of him telling his supporters that if I ever lose an election, it's because it was rigged and I expect you to do something about it. 5 years of out and out in the open saying without saying it, without directly saying it, that like, I want you guys to go to bat for me if I ever need you to, but I'm not actually going to say it or give
proud
the order.
Proud boys stand by. Like, are you kidding me?
Proud boys stand by.
Yep.
And they all acknowledged what he was saying. They all were like, standing by, Mr. President, standing by, sir. And then he has the rally in Georgia a few weeks before the 6th, where he's very careful, of course, with his language. He can't say, hey, guys, I want you to go into the Capitol and break into the building and try to hang Mike Pence if he doesn't force this certification to not happen. You know, like,
which he doesn't have the power to.
Yeah, and of course he can't say that, but he says, well, we're hoping Mike Pence comes through for us, and if he doesn't, that'll be bad for him, and we're going to have to show a lot of force. So he's very careful with his wording, but all they need from him is him to say the next day, well, I denounce what happened yesterday. I think it was despicable, and I denounce it. But it's like, yes, but the day before, while it was happening, you said, we love you very much, you're very special, but it's time to go home now. They did steal this from us, and I understand why you're mad, but it's time to go home now. And again, like, if you can't read between the lines on this stuff, you're not doing a good job of thinking critically. But I just challenged this friend. I was like, you're so skeptical of everything. How come all you need from him is for him to just say, hey, I didn't tell them to do that. And then you're like, good enough for me. Good enough for me. I don't need to dig any deeper or think any harder about this. And just there's just the prayer and the hope that someone can like actually go, you know, that's a good point. Like, I say that I question things and then I think critically, but anytime this guy says something, I just go along with it. Like, yeah. I don't know. It probably won't happen, but it might plant a seed. I don't know.
I don't know. And there's this lingering feeling of like, there's nothing I can do, you know? Screaming on social media doesn't do anything. And I think the thing that makes me the saddest about it is like, there's nothing I can do. But I do feel like it's going to end up being like what the Mormon church does, essentially. Where we'll have to like go on like missions to our friends and neighbors who are Trump supporters and be like, and just sit down with them face to face and have real, honest, emotional conversations about intellectual issues and not intellectual debates about intellectual issues, because Trump supporters are not supporting Donald Trump based on intelligence. They will make up whatever intelligence or fabrication that they have to in order to continue to feel the same emotion that being a Donald Trump supporter makes them feel, which is being seen for as not the nobody that everybody else thinks that they are. You know, haven't you seen that every Trump supporter, you know, is a person that like has like hidden self-esteem issues?
Oh,
or like
totally 100% abandonment issues.
I don't know abandonment issues. I don't know one confident, self-assured Trump supporter. Not one person that like is like a very in their body, emotionally in tune human being. And that I think is the most telling thing. That bullying these people who already feel bullied by whatever insert trauma here is not going to be the way that we get them back, you know?
Right. It is fascinating to talk about like sitting down and having emotional conversations with people. You said that word, and I like that, because that's another big fallacy that they love to bring out of their bag of recycled, you know, word vomit that everyone uses. Everyone uses the line, sorry, I think for myself, and you know, hey, facts don't care about your feelings. Everyone loves parroting that great Ben Shapiro, you know, win all card, facts don't care about your feelings, you know, and they'll criticize liberals for being too emotional or getting emotional about something. I said to these guys the other day, I was like, hey guys, like, I know that you've really bought hook, line, and sinker into this whole thing of like facts don't care about your feelings. First of all, being emotional about my argument doesn't make me wrong. There is no, there's nothing in philosophy or in the world of reality that says if I care about my stance on something and if I care deeply about it, I automatically must be wrong. And second of all, Your argument is emotional. Like, of course it is. It is the entire reason you are a Trump supporter is because of the way it makes you feel. And so, yeah, you're right on with that.
It's like, yeah. I don't know. I do not know. I have not met, nor do I think I ever will meet a Trump supporter who will tell me the origin story of how they became a Trump supporter. And it will not be that it will not involve because every one of my friends and neighbors believe in that. And I do not believe it will be. Well, because I just listened to the things that he was saying, and I thought that they were right, and they were really, you know, intellectually sound, and there was all this evidence, and, you know, they did this really incredible episode on, I think it was The Daily, that podcast, The Daily, by the New York Times, where they interviewed a woman about why she flipped from a Democrat to a Republican, and you know, she was actually trying to say to this reporter, you know, I was listening to Donald Trump in 2015, 2016, and the things that he was saying made a lot of sense to me. And, you know, there was all this evidence and all this fact. And I was like, well, I'm just going to be a Trump supporter. But she lives in Atlanta and in Georgia. And this reporter was saying that, you know, all of these things that she was saying were actual facts, were actual just conspiracy theories that she had been hearing. And, you know, and that she believes that this woman actually feels just more seen in her community because she's a Trump supporter now, you know?
Right.
It's just like being seen. It's all emotional.
I had a guy say that to me. He admitted that to me. He came in the comments of a friend. Do you know Tristan? Yeah, he came in the comments of one of Tristan's posts, and he said that, like, we're all freaking out about the six, but every time Planet of the Apes rallies around Black Lives Matter, you guys say nothing. And he called Black Lives Matter protest Planet of the Apes. And I commented,
wow,
and
terrible.
I said, go fuck yourself. And I wasn't nice about it. I said, hey man, go fuck yourself. Like 100%, I'm not trying to debate you on this. Go fuck yourself. You're a piece of shit. And I was like really mean to this guy. Cause I was just like, absolutely not. You're not going to come in the year 2021 on my friend's Facebook wall, who's black, and call black protesters Planet of the Apes. Like, go fuck yourself. And
yeah, terrible.
And so everyone started telling this guy to go fuck himself. And he said, you guys don't even want to find out why I think the things that I think. He goes, has it ever occurred to you that maybe something bad happened to me that made me the way that I am? And I responded to him and I was like, I have no doubt in my mind and in my heart that something bad happened to you that made you this racist. Like, I have no doubt. I honestly don't care. I want you to do better and figure it out. Like, I want you to go get help. I want you, but like right now in this instance, when you come out on my friend's wall and say something like this, I'm going to have no tolerance for it. And I'm going
to
have,
again, it's so much easier to say something like Planet of the Apes than to actually, you know, do the hard work that it requires to change.
Yeah.
It's just easier to be a racist than to like face the things about yourself that you don't like, have to like make concessions to your comfort and then make the changes. Humans just don't like to change.
Well, and to that point, that's another positive thing that we can maybe try to leave this on. Cause I don't necessarily know that we're going to be able to figure this out or figure out the solution or anything like that.
No, absolutely not.
But
yeah.
The idea that, and you started with this too, and I like this a lot, that like humans, so many people are addicted to comfort and don't want, and are so cripplingly terrified of change. Now, this is a pattern we have seen throughout human history. At every moment of social progress, at every opportunity to take a step forward into a more civilized, inclusive, kind, compassionate, evolved species, there has always been a significant contingent of the species that has resisted with all their might that progress, that change, that step forward. It is all it has always been met with violent opposition, always. And so we're not necessarily seeing something new here as far as the species is concerned. We may be seeing something new as far as our country and our democracy is concerned, but as far as the human species is concerned, pretty much every time we're trying to take steps into a more enlightened, evolved people, that process of collective growth and collective change is met with some pretty harsh opposition from...
Yeah. And I would, you know, I mean, like, I'm an extremely existential human being to a fault, I think. But I wonder what it would be like if we as a species all agreed that the goal of human life on Earth isn't to be comfortable, that no one's life has ever been comfortable and everyone fights for comfort, but never actually ever gets there. And so the sooner we just realize that life is uncomfortable and we all have work to do, that maybe the work that we have to do will actually begin. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that was kind of really beautiful and like moving. And like, I think you just like slammed the nail on the head with that one. Like, life is not actually meant to be comfortable. Have you ever been comfortable in your life? Mm-mm. You are always facing discomfort and figuring out how to manage it and figuring out how to move through it.
Yeah. And the further away from discomfort you lean, the more discomfortable your life becomes.
Right.
You know, the more problems you have. Human life literally is just like, every single day you wake up and you have to do things you don't want to do. And the more you push back the things that you don't want to do, the more things you have to do that you don't want to do.
Yeah, this is exactly how the process of getting sober was for me. This is exactly how the process of going to therapy is for so many people. This is it's like you don't.
And that's why you drink alcohol in the first place.
Right.
Right.
You're uncomfortable.
Because it took away the feeling that you had to sort of deal with everything.
Yep. It made me less uncomfortable. It made me, for a few hours at a time, feel good. Feel like I don't have to worry and I don't have any responsibilities and I don't have to like do any hard work. I don't have to like care about like what people think about me. I don't, you know, and now.
And so now think about a Trump supporter who, you know, their party lost the White House, the House of Representatives and the Senate. You know how uncomfortable that is. It's so much easier to just be like, nope, it was stolen, it was all a hoax, instead of like having to do the work in yourself to be like, okay, a person I didn't vote for, one with who has policies I might not agree with, and maybe I should look into those policies to see how I actually feel about them. Believing conspiracy theories is the laziest thing on the planet. It's just like, there's no facts. I don't have to do any reading. I don't have to do any mental gymnastics. I'm just like, oh, here's a sentence that sort of allows me just to continue being comfortable with my life, and I'm going to roll with that.
You just killed it. Like, that's exactly it. That's 100% it. Because accepting accountability and fault in that and going, maybe it was us, maybe we alienated voters, maybe some of our rhetoric,
that's hard work. That's really hard work,
and it's uncomfortable work, and it hurts the ego. It's very difficult. I was talking to my sponsee earlier today, because he was acknowledging to me, he was like, I think I have something of a victim complex. And I was like, we all do, bud. And I was like, yeah. I was like, for years, I had a big resentment about this DUI that I got because I felt like the cops treated me really poorly in that interaction. And he was telling me a story about like where he felt like he was treated poorly by the police officers. And I'm like, and I had this resentment about like, they were not fair with me. But like, the bottom line is, I drove drunk several hundred times over the course of 11 years, and I got caught once and I was reaping, I was literally reaping what I had sown, and I was getting off easy, frankly.
Yeah. And it's so much easier. It's so much easier to be like, the cops treated me unfairly than to be like, I drove drunk and got caught.
Yep.
Yep.
I was putting my life and other people's lives in danger and being selfish and reckless.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, and like their behavior is really none of my concern. Like that's not how I get better from this. It is by sitting and thinking about what about when you guys did this? Well, what about this? Well, what about that? It's like, listen, how'd we get here? You know? And that's another one of those critical thinking questions. Is it's like, and you asked it at the beginning, how did we get here? And that's what I want to ask these people too, who are like, they weren't there to assassinate politicians. They weren't there. Like, I'm like, well then why were they there? How did they get there? How did this happen? If Donald Trump did not incite it, how did this happen? And would it have happened if he had conceded the election when the AP called it for Joe Biden? If he had come out and said—
And how come Democrats have never done this?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where's the Democrat mob riot when Trump was elected or whatever, you know?
If he had come out and said, you know what, we fought a good fight and President-elect Biden waged a good campaign and we lost this one, folks, but it's all right. We'll bounce back from this. Would there have been one, you know, what happened on January 6th? And
no, not at all.
Bottom line, it's just like, how did we get here? So,
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I'm gonna wrap that up. I think I like that ending place of talking about the doing the hard work, and thank you for talking to me about that. I'm gonna hit stop on the recording, but let's keep talking. My favorite voice in the late night game, maybe my favorite voice on all of cable television lately. And over the last 4 years has been Seth Meyers of Late Night with Seth Meyers. It's weird because the guy who had the job before him was Conan O'Brien. And I love Conan O'Brien. Don't get me wrong. Conan O'Brien is hilarious and maybe one of the funniest people to ever have a talk show. But Seth Meyers' show is just different. It is funny. And I do find myself laughing at the jokes that he and his staff come up with. But really what it is just straightforward, direct, no bullshit political commentary. He spent the last 4 years, the entire Trump presidency, doing a nightly recap of what's going on in the news and really in the world of the Trump presidency in a segment called A Closer Look. And he would break down why the most recent thing that happened was insane, why it was illegal, why it was bad, whatever it was. And he would do it, you know, with occasionally making jokes, but a lot of the time he was just straight up reporting the news, and in a way where he really wasn't trying to be nice about it or say it in a way that was diplomatic or that would, you know, kind of please maybe conservative producers of the show, like whatever it was. I mean, Lorne Michaels is the producer of the show, but you know, GE, who owns NBC and all that, who knows who's got money going to NBC and what their political persuasions are. But I just really respected and still do the integrity of that program and the fact that like Seth and his staff have been kind of given a green light to just say what they mean and speak from the heart during many of the harder hitting stories of the Trump presidency, you know, the impeachment, the revelation that he doesn't pay his taxes, the Russia investigation, the first time he was elected, and he said that the popular vote margin was fraudulent and that those were illegal votes, and all the racist things that he said over the years about people from Africa coming from shithole countries and the ban on countries where Muslims come from and just all of the awful things. Seth Meyers and his team covered it wonderfully. I recently spent the last, couple months because, you know, quarantine and you have stuff that you watch. I went through and I watched like the majority of his show's covering of the Trump years, and it was really, really fascinating, and I stay up to date with it. The reason why I'm saying all this is, A, I feel like people are sleeping on that show. I don't necessarily think you need to watch the whole thing. Like, you don't need to watch him interviewing guests unless you like that, or it's a long program, but I definitely think if you've got YouTube, and you do, you should watch A Closer Look and really just that, and check in maybe with his monologues. His nightly monologues are really, really good. He just seems like a real person. He seems like he's friends with his writing staff. He seems like a writer who just got the job of being a host, which is who Conan O'Brien was, and who all the best late night hosts are, I believe. You know, John Oliver was just a comedy writer who got to be the guy in front of the camera. But I'm bringing all this up because on January 6th, 2021, Seth Meyers and his staff did what I just did. They called an audible and they threw out their script for the day and they decided to start their show by just speaking directly to the audience and being extremely clear about exactly what it was that happened and exactly what they think needs to be done in order for us to have any chance of healing. And I just found it to be so beautiful and refreshing to hear someone with a platform that size say it as clear as this. And I wanted to leave you with this today, this audio clip from Late Night with Seth Meyers. I hope that you find it as clear-headed and articulate and succinct as I did. And I just hope that we're all okay moving forward. That's the show this week. We'll be back with another episode next week. Stay safe out there. Thanks.
Welcome to Late Night. It's 12:37. We're live and very grateful to be here with you. I swear we were writing jokes today. And then, as everyone knows by now, today was a day filled with surreal and horrifying scenes of armed insurrection and attempt to destroy, through violent means, American democracy. It was a sequence of events unseen and the modern history of this nation. And the images should be seared into our collective consciousness for the rest of our lives. And so because of that, our show will be a little different tonight. In a few moments, we'll be talking with MSNBC's Nicole Wallace, as well as rapper and activist Killer Mike, to break down what happened and what it means going forward. But first, I think it's important, as the first draft of history is being written, and as we're all processing what we witnessed today, to be as plain-spoken and clear-eyed as possible. What we saw today was a violent insurgency, an attempt to overthrow the legitimately elected government of the United States. And it was incited, directed, and encouraged by the president, Donald Trump, and more than a few members of the Republican Party and right-wing media. A violent mob of Trump supporters stormed the Capitol. They violently forced their way onto the Senate floor and into the office of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and climbed onto the side of the Capitol where they replaced an American flag with a Trump flag. They carried weapons in violation of the law, and they made it clear what they wanted. They broadcasted it to the world. Some shouted, "Trump won the election," from the Senate dais. Others waved Confederate flags, and their goal was clear: to disrupt and subvert the lawful counting of electoral votes and prevent Joe Biden from taking office as the legitimately elected president. And as we were all watching these stunning scenes of violence and sedition, of insurrection against our democracy, anxiously hoping for a restoration of calm and order, the president of the United States told the traitors and the mob, "We love you. You're very special. I know how you feel." And he does. He knows how they feel because he spent 4 years telling them in great and odious detail how they should feel. So we can be shocked, but we can't be surprised. The president wanted this. He directed it, supported it, he incited it, and encouraged it. He told that same crowd just hours earlier that they should never concede, that they should show strength and fight. His personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, told the crowd they should have a trial by combat. And for years, the president and his band of seditious henchmen in the Republican Party and in the right-wing media ecosystem have fed their rabid base a steady diet of unhinged fantasies and conspiracy theories as a substitute for leadership and governance. The people who listen to Donald Trump, to the Republican Party, to Fox News, and all the rest, what they've been told for years and what they were told again today was that their country was being stolen from them, that shadowy groups and powerful forces were coming for them, that they should never accept defeat, that they should fight. For 2 months, they've been fed monstrous, inflammatory lies about the election, and now here we are. Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, and the rest of the Sedition Caucus in the House and Senate goaded this on. They're responsible for this. They should wear this shame and disgrace for the rest of their lives. No one who aided and abetted today's actions should ever be allowed to serve in a democracy they so clearly detest. There must be consequences for stoking violence and sedition. Otherwise, we're gonna see it again. And as for Trump, the only way our democracy will survive this harrowing moment is if he is immediately removed from office by either the cabinet or the Congress and prosecuted. Anything less is tacit permission to continue to use his office and his influence after he leaves office to foment sedition and dismantle democracy. And if our government fails to act, they'll be assenting to the violent destruction of the democracy they claim to care so much about. And I think it's worth noting that while this is the first time most of us have witnessed anything like this in our lifetimes, our country has really only been a full democracy where everyone can vote for about 55 years. In fact, one of the many great shames of what occurred today is that it eclipsed a historic moment, a shining glimmer of hope from last night in Georgia. There were black voters who went to the polls in unprecedented numbers to exercise a right that just 55 years ago they did not have. They elected the first black senator to represent the state and the first black Democrat to represent any southern state in the Senate. They also elected the Jewish son of an immigrant, and in doing so, also helped repudiate the violent, racist authoritarianism of Trump and his movement, a movement that has never been embraced by a majority of Americans and which has been rejected by voters over and over again. We've seen violent insurrection in this country before. In 1898, a mob of white supremacist terrorists marched on City Hall in Wilmington, North Carolina, and staged a violent coup to overthrow the legitimately elected biracial local government. Multiracial, pluralistic democracy is fragile and precious, and it requires our vigilant stewardship and protection. And anyone not willing to forward that project with the fullness of their effort must be shamed and disgraced and removed from office. And that must start immediately with Donald Trump.